Hey, everybody. This is JL. I know this isn't the exact normal way the podcast starts, but it's Sunday, January 26th. I was just finishing about an hour ago a great episode, which you'll be able to hear after this brief sort of eulogy, I guess, or numb announcement. Episode was great. I don't sort of look at my phone or anything when I'm doing the podcast. I just sort of zone out and go through what I want to talk about. And so when I was done, I was like, boom, we're going to put this episode up early. Nailed it. This is like a real old school JL's got his, I think I compared it to Jordan scoring 55 against the Knicks after kind of the game that announced that he was fully back after being playing baseball for a couple of years. And then I had multiple messages and alerts on my phone and some texts from people saying that Kobe had died in, my best friend John, who's away with words and texts, I had a text from him that said, Kobe. That could literally mean anything. Like, anything from criminal accusations to insulting Trump to another highlight or something, how he came out of retirement. But I guessed it was bad. And then I had another text from a friend who is uses more words that said, Kobe died in a helicopter? Question mark. Brutal. And he did. So as I record this, I thought it would be weird to have my podcast go out as much as I was pleased with the episode. And anybody who's a fan of my podcasting will, I think, enjoy the episode for sure. It's a long one, but it's a really good one. So hopefully you enjoy it. But I felt like it'd be weird to put out an episode without addressing the Kobe thing, even though it just happened. So I'm not going to get into, as I speak, he is deceased. That is confirmed, but there may have been other members of his family on the helicopter. Suggestions that another former Laker might have been on the helicopter. That I don't know. But sort of weird that the very first episode of podcasting I ever did was January 2012. First episode of the Righteous Brick Podcast, which used to be, for its first few years, the format was basically I would debate and discuss something that I thought was overrated with a fan or defender of that thing. And most of the time, humor ensued, some thoughtful discussion, a lot of humor, and it was a fun, kind of somewhat unique take. So I did that. That was kind of the format for 3 or 4 years, and then it occasionally would be that format, and I would talk about other things, and now we have our new format, which is the Bill Burr, the homeless man Bill Burr's format of just ranting and discussing different things, and some people still seem to like it, so that's good. But Kobe was the first topic. And I remember comedian Brian McGinnis was the first guest, huge fan of Kobe. So I've already reached out to him and said, sorry, this is terrible. Because that's, you know, all jokes aside, he's a huge fan of the guy. And it's very sad. It's a human tragedy. Obviously, it's a huge sports tragedy. The man had young children, was moving on with his life after a career. 41 is literally, you know, he's 6 months older than me. So, but the debate was obviously fun to say, oh, Kobe's overrated, blah, blah, blah. And I defended myself, and I used stats and percentages, and he's no Jordan, and LeBron's better, and the usual arguments. But I remember McGinnis, I think at some point, we finally boiled it down after like an hour of arguing where McGinnis was like, okay, so basically you're saying he's like not top five, but he's top 15 or whatever. Or like, oh, so you're saying he's top 10, but not higher than that. And that's probably the best you can do. And that's kind of a funny way to summarize the argument. It was like, even if you didn't like Kobe, you couldn't really have, unless you're Bill Simmons, who also hates Karl Malone, who's my guy. But no way to have him really outside of your top 12, maybe if you're a real stickler for a bunch of bullshit, like 15. But for a lot of people, he's going to be in their top 5, top 8. He was a phenomenal player, a phenomenal athlete. Obviously, off the court issues aside, during the middle of his career, I know that's a way of sugarcoating it. I've certainly said some things about him and the assault charges. So I'm not going to do that now. But a great ambassador for the game in terms of spreading it. Obviously, he's with the rise of the NBA in China, it's like him and Yao Ming are like co-favorite players of all time in China. That's how big he was in China. But it's really sad. And I didn't want the episode to go by without sort of addressing it. It seems sort of weird to drop a new episode and have people be like, he's not going to talk about Kobe at all. And that was my first episode of the podcast. So all jokes aside, he was a phenomenal, phenomenal player. And it's just, but I'm, you know, people who die with young kids too early and not naturally is always something that's going to make me sad, whatever you think of the person or whatever ups and downs they've had in their life. So so any Kobe fans out there, I feel for you. You know, it's obviously you didn't know him. He wasn't your friend, but certainly as somebody who played basketball throughout my youth and through college, appreciate what athletes can mean and how they can inspire or just entertain. And Kobe was like one of the, of the people between the ages of 15 and 45, you're really only probably, going to have the three top guys will be Jordan, LeBron, and Kobe. Obviously a weirdo like me will like Stockton and Malone, but if you polled every NBA fan, that's going to be your top three most popular, famous, basketball players of my life. Maybe Magic Johnson creeps in there as well. But, yeah, it's very sad. So I know this is a weird way to start the episode, but at least you can pause this. You can listen to this part, pause it, and come back to the episode because I know it's a long one. But this is sadly one of, I think a great episode if you've been a fan of my podcasting. So I just felt like I needed to address, sort of the elephant in the podcasting room. Hopefully Kobe's family, it will be okay, his friends and his fans. Obviously, at least you got to see his complete body of work, at least as a player. But obviously, who's to say he won, a short Oscar last year or 2 years ago. So it's like, who knows what else maybe he could have done. And obviously, losing a father as a young girl is a tragedy. So rest in peace and hopefully and well wishes to all your fans. So yeah. That's it. So anybody who listened to the show knows that he was the first topic. So it would be weird if I didn't address it. And it's sort of huge news. And even I'm just sort of like, whoa, it's sad. And it seems crazy. Obviously regular people die tragically every day, but these always do seem to hit more people because their lives impacted more people. So with that, you can continue on to this week's great episode. Or you can just take a pause if, I don't think this probably puts you in the right mind space for a funny and intense podcast episode touching on all sorts of issues, but I wanted to say something before because I felt like it would have been even weirder not to address it. So have a good week. Hope you enjoy this podcast, and sorry to all the Kobe fans out there who are listening. It's a sad day for anybody who likes sports or basketball. So that's it. So hopefully maybe the episode will distract you or cheer you up if you continue to listen going forward, or if you take a break, hopefully enjoy it later in the week. So, thanks.
You can't handle the truth. Should we or should we not follow the advice of the galactically stupid?
Maybe. Maybe not. Maybe fuck yourself.
You are a bunch of fucking assholes. You know why? You don't have the guts to be what you want to be. You need people like me. You need people like me so you can point your fucking fingers and say, that's the bad guy.
Clearly, don't know who you're talking to, so let me clue you in. I am not in danger, Skyler. I am the danger. A guy opens his door and gets shot, and you think that of me? No. I am the one who knocks.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Righteous Perk Podcast. I'm your host, J.L. Covan. It is Sunday, January 26, 2020, 1:40 p.m. New Jersey time. Just got out of my morning ritual of mass, followed by reading at Starbucks, followed by a should I go to the gym or sit on my couch for 5 hours enjoying the one day, much like the Lord who rested on Sundays. This is the day the girlfriend works on Sundays. And so Sunday is my one day where I just say, is there something I want to watch that she doesn't like? Is there, from Netflix to pornography, is there something that she would not enjoy watching with me? or do I take a trip to see mom in Riverdale, which is always an all-day thing because the New Jersey Transit is like you can get the 11:05 a.m. or the 1:05 p.m. or the 10 p.m. train. I'm exaggerating, but it's a really shitty weekend system. So it ends up being some kind of crazy. It's a 3 hour journey to get to the home I grew up in to visit my mom for 14 minutes before I say, okay, and I got to get back. I need another 3.5 hours to time these trains right. So that's often a Sunday ritual. But today is one of those days where I say I've done my little reading at Starbucks with a healthy green tea and an even healthier giant slab of red velvet cake. Because you got to balance it out, folks, okay? It's about putting – I'm more of a well-oiled machine, so food and drink are more fuel for my machinery. So you get that green tea in you because it's good. It's good for the metabolism. It's good for your teeth. You wash it down with you treat yourself to a 480 calorie slice of red velvet cake after mass, and you promise the Lord that you'll do better next week. So my Sunday ritual is sort of over, and now I have a dilemma. I have to start writing an episode of my series, which of course we'll get into later, but it's just it's the next journey. It's the next chapter in my book called Entertainment Failures. So we've really closed about 16 to 20 chapters on stand-up comedy. It didn't end well if you've been following my career. And now it's time to become failed screenwriter. And after that, I think I'll go the easiest route, which is to become wildly successful DJ. And then finally conclude my life with a one-man show. Good God, one man... We'll get into stand-up in a little bit and different things. Some critiques I, of course, have about the business and the art in 2020. But let's see. My voice has finally recovered because... So the point is, this weekend, once I had the piece of red velvet cake, I said, well, I guess the gym's not happening today because, you know, once you do that, once you cross that Rubicon, or at least this is the way I operate, I used to not be this way. You know, when I was really jacked and really gave a shit, I'd be like, well, sure, I drank 20 beers last night and ate a fucking calzone for breakfast, but fuck it. I'm going to the gym for 2.5 hours. We're going to sweat this shit out, bro. But now I'm more like, well, I did have those peanuts, and those aren't keto-friendly, so fuck today. No gym. All snacks, all Netflix. We'll start over. Fresh start tomorrow. So I'm here, I'm queer, get used to it. I'm not queer. This is weird. I have like my late night delusional ranting skills, like my ranting going every direction verbiage is already at like 11 p.m. on a Wednesday level where I'm just like, I don't know what I'm talking about, but maybe I'm just speaking in tongues after mass. Maybe that's what I'm doing right now. But my voice has recovered because Friday I took the day off. I had 3 vacation days carried over from my job to this year, but those vacation days have to be used before April 1st. So I said, well, assuming I don't get any gigs, which by the way, if you're a betting man or woman, or you don't identify, if you're a betting person, if you're a betting individual who identifies as we gamble, if you're a gambling entity, I believe that is woke enough, If you were a gambling entity, you should gamble on me not getting any gigs for the rest of my life. That seems to be the safe bet. But I think what I will probably do is take 2 days off for that Thursday, Friday of March Madness, post up at a bar, and you know, do something I probably haven't done in 15 years, which is just sit in a bar with tons of TV, eating bar food all day, watching 5 million college basketball games. But that means I still have 1 day that I'm going to have to use before April. And I said, you know what? I'm recording this album in Toms River, New Jersey. So why don't I just take today off? Because the plan was to go to work at like 8 a.m., work until 5 p.m., catch a 5:30 bus out to Toms River, and then record an entire Trump album. And it's a good thing I took the day off, because instead I got out there to record with Aaron Hodges of You Lucky Dog Productions, who did my first Trump album, Fireside Craps. Well, this one's going to most likely be called Fireside Craps The Deuce. And I got to say, people, I sometimes I can be very critical of myself and my career. I'm often laudatory of my own art, and this is no exception to that. This is going to be, I think, a significant improvement. Not, and this is improvement meaning the first one was good. This one, I think, is going to be phenomenal, although I do think we should get it out sooner rather than later, since today, and we'll get to the impeachment a little later, but since this morning, while I was in church after eating my vitamins, I was saying my prayers just to, you know, honor Hulk Hogan. And Donald Trump was offering very thinly veiled threats on Adam Schiff's life. But we'll get to that later. So basically, Trump is really narrowing the gap of how much longer one can find a Trump impression funny. You know, as I've joked in the past, I feel like I'm sitting on a great Hitler impression in 1932. So there is a time, there is a definite timer on when I will stop doing the Trump. Though, to be honest, whether or not he encourages some sort of mass murder or slaughter or becomes just like a full-on dictator enabled by the GOP, I'm not doing the Trump shit after 2020, for sure. Like, win or lose or whatever, the Trump impression, I'll leave it to fucking garbage hacks who can't hold my Trump adult diaper. See that? What I did there, instead of a jock, I made fun of his age and incontinence. I'll leave it to them to continue to try and make money off of this, which I obviously haven't really been able to do, despite having my Trump impression is like a schoolyard legend version, like you know, where it's had like success, but it, like, somewhere along the line my Trump impression smoked crack and, you know, became a pimp and then got thrown in jail for 5 years. Like, I don't know what, you know, maybe my Trump impression one day will have like a nice redemption story. Like, his Trump impression never quite made it to where people expected. A lot of people said it was better than all the other ones that were making money on Comedy Central and SNL. But you know what? In his old age, the Trump impression ended up becoming a community activist and giving scared straight talks to other impressions to encourage them to get a real job and to not depend on the voice of a wannabe dictator for their livelihood. So the album itself, it took, I don't want to make this sound like it was real work, because Aaron has this phenomenal studio at his place, home built, but goddamn, it's so nice. And it's so nice to just sit in, forget to work in. It was a pleasure to work in, but it's like, I would just sit in that fucking studio and read all day if that were my house. So kudos to Aaron. You know, another guy trying to build himself up. And the only reason I've ever worked, as I've said, I don't work with labels for my albums, except for his, because his terms are more favorable. I know him. I trust him. And I trust somebody who has the same bootstrap, scrappy, take a chance on yourself mentality for their label. I've written about this in the past, but Comedy Dynamics is the biggest bad boy in the world of comedy album and special producing. And I wouldn't work with them. And I'll explain, not that they've come to me to work with me, but I'll explain why I wouldn't work with them. And I don't care how this sounds. This is just the truth. And this isn't hating or me. But I was, for about 6 months of my life, represented, not in writing, by New Wave Entertainment, which was Barry Katz, a sort of legendary figure in comedy management. There's almost no huge comedian that you like right now that didn't get their start or a leg up through Barry Katz. Repped Chappelle when he was really young. Like the guy looks like Dirk Nowitzki, and he was a huge, not Chappelle, Barry Katz. So basically they were intrigued by me, and I've told this story before, but my manager, who I still keep in contact with because he's a huge NBA fan, but he reps screenwriters now. Hint, hint, maybe I can get my scripts to him. But I, as a young comic, made the foolish mistake of it was my manager, not the agency, but the manager was very high on me. And he was really pushing my stuff. He got me a couple of TV credits very early on, which went very well. And then he was let go. And I never learned the circumstances of why he was let go. But it seemed, I don't know why or what had happened. But I opted to stay with New Wave because I was like, well, I'm 4 years in, 5 years in, and they rep Dane Cook and they're huge. And it's one thing I know. It's like nothing was happening for me before I got with this big name place. But then I got assigned to some woman agent, and maybe this is where my women in comedy anger started. Just kidding. But I don't think she was a big fan of my comedy. I did nothing wrong personally, but I just don't think she was digging my shit. And I was basically promoted for nothing. It also hurt that I was going to do, they were going to book me again for the Late Late Show, and then the writer's strike hit in 08. And by the time the writer's strike was over, I had a new manager who didn't. I was assigned a new manager who didn't give a shit about what I was doing. So then they dropped me like a few months later. So all the heat from my first national TV appearance and another regional TV appearance I did was sort of dying down. Now, it helped me get some road work early on just as a credit. But the Late Late Show then stopped returning my emails. It was like even though I legitimately crushed the set that I had, they just stopped returning my emails. It was like, oh, once you don't have somebody to vouch for you, like it was kind of like, but you do know I just did your show and crushed it, right? This wasn't my imagination. I'm not like, people weren't blowing smoke up my ass. I destroyed that set. So it was like, I'm still the same guy. Can you just let, no? Okay. So me and New Wave go our separate ways. I was never signed. I think they wanted to see how much heat I could generate. And the fact that I wasn't willing to move to LA probably hurt my chances. But I felt like I was doing the smart thing. I probably wasn't. But I felt like, well, if they're not signing me, at the time I was engaged, still the number one mistake I've ever made in my life, even worse than when I started doing stand-up comedy. That's how bad a mistake it was. But I was engaged at the time. I was working at a law firm that was paying me a shit ton of money. And I figured, well, I got skills and you obviously are interested in me enough. So I'm not like uprooting my life, especially if you haven't like signed a contract with me and kind of given me that sort of ironclad relationship that I can rely on. So I was playing it smart, but one could also argue I was playing it safe and even a little scared. Despite the advice of my counsel, AKA my very wise older brother, who had said once I got laid off from my law firm during the recession, he said, if you're going to pursue comedy, you should go to LA. And I said, what? He goes, I don't want you to go out to LA, but this is a tough thing you're thinking about pursuing full time. And if you go to LA, you will be completely focused on it. You won't know many people. You will not be familiar with the area. The only reason you are out there is to succeed and to try and make it as a stand-up comic and entertainer. If you stay in New York, you'll be around your family. You'll be around your friends. You'll know everything. You'll be in a comfort zone that won't make you as hungry. He never pursued anything like comedy, but obviously those were very wise words from her, from him, and very prescient, because now I'm sitting in an apartment podcasting in New Jersey. So not how I anticipated this working out. But anyway, a few years later, I'm at the Boston Comedy Festival, just a random like Saturday, and I get a call, and I'm like, any comic listening to this who's ever had a little buzz or a little bit of anything, you see like an 818 number, like a Los Angeles number that you don't know, you're like, oh shit, it finally worked. That video I put out, or that album I put out, or that fucking bit I did at a bar show on a Tuesday night in Brooklyn, they know what's up. So of course I'm like, boom, hello. And it was the people from New Wave, which had become New Wave Dynamics, that was now branching into sort of creating a comedy catalog. And they wanted me to sign over my first two albums. They were like, "Oh, we love, you know, hey, we you know, it's been a while. How are you? Bup, bup, bup. Hey, we're LA. Hey, does my voice sound like it's tickling your balls yet? Because I think you're the bee's knees." And they were like, "We'd be interested in maybe getting your, you know, the rights to your albums. We have a much bigger distribution network. We're on the come up." They didn't use that phrase, but it was like, "We're putting together a big thing, and you'll be part of this network." And bup, 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 bup. And I just said, "Nah, I'm good." And here's why I said that. It was like, you guys had a relationship with me as a comic. You then terminated that relationship. But now that you're putting together a big catalog of albums, you now want to get the rights of my comedy with some sort of distribution agreement, even though you don't want to represent me. I don't understand that. Now, the people at New Wave, which then became New Wave Dynamics, obviously became Comedy Dynamics. And it's basically like, in the world of comedy specials, for those of you that are listening and don't know, in the world of comedy specials, it's as if I was telling Disney to fuck off. But they weren't yet Disney. Now they're Disney. Now they're the biggest name in comedy specials by a mile. And thanks to Netflix, which is allowing them to just fill the market with comedy special gluttony, they have these relationships, especially with Netflix, that are like the spigot. It's like an oil. It's like Netflix is like a fucking, you've struck oil in terms of the revenue that can come in, because Netflix is just like, "My content, give us content, give us fucking content." Yes, I was just doing like a money shot, like a woman getting a money shot gesture by myself in the apartment. Although my dog Cookie is not looking at me right now, but she is present as well. So Comedy Dynamics now has no incentive to like curate the art or to be like, "Not everybody's good enough for us," because there's just like, it's like the more shit we can pump out, the more money there is. Like, the bubble has not burst and we are becoming gajillionaires just pumping out content. And what I've seen with Comedy Dynamics and other album labels, they're the biggest and the baddest, but what they must have seen coming was the biggest, and I've told people this, the biggest source of revenue that I've had in the last 5 years as a stand-up comedian has not been gigs. It has not been album sales. It has not been private gigs. It has been streaming money from satellite radio and sites like Pandora. That has been at least 70 to 75% of the money I've made as a stand-up comic in the last 3 or 4 years. And I think they maybe saw the writing on the wall or anticipated that becoming something. So what they want to do is buy my albums, secure streaming rights. And who's to say they wouldn't have fucked me in the ass for those streaming rights? Like, that I wouldn't have even known, because I wouldn't have known that was even going to be a thing. They might have said, "Hey, we're going to split album sales 50-50 with you," which I think it was something like that. But because they're going to promote it to their huge network, nobody's ever heard of me. At least I was humble enough to go, "I know I'm going to be great as a comic, but I am not great as a celebrity. And who the fuck is going to randomly buy my albums just because you're telling them to, if you've also got a catalog of hundreds of artists?" There's nothing making me stand out that people are going to go, "Well, I always trust their product, so why don't I buy another 5,000 albums from Comedy Dynamics?" It wasn't going to happen. So what they were doing was they were going to secure that as some sort of sharing. And I don't even remember, because I shut it down. I just had a bad feeling about it. It's like getting a booty call from somebody who broke up with you and never called you again. And then all of a sudden they want to meet up for drinks at 11 p.m. on a Saturday. Like, this, what? At least meet me for lunch on a Tuesday. I'm no fucking whore. But I didn't agree to it. But I feel like they must have known the streaming oil geyser was coming. And I'm glad, obviously, I've not signed over any of my album rights except for the Trump albums. They all are 100% mine. And I made some nice money from that by keeping the rights. But then Comedy Dynamics got into the specials game, and now they make so many albums. And what I always see is, and it's not just Comedy Dynamics, there's a few other album labels out there. 800-Pound Gorilla is I think, probably the next biggest. They lure comics in who haven't accomplished much because they can promise you a great recording. They can promise you a booking, maybe at some place you wouldn't be able to headline or get booked. They'll promise you to pay all upfront costs, And then they'll want to split, they'll want like in perpetuity to basically split the revenue. And that's a horrible deal because they'll lure you in with, hey, you get a nice recording, we'll pay. It's a $1,200 value. We'll cover that. We'll do the artwork. We'll, so they'll put in like $2,500. And you will, you know, you in your first year, if they get it in rotation, and I'm sure these albums, and I'm sure Comedy Dynamics and 800 Pound Gorillas, without question, has deals with streaming services and rate and Sirius. I guarantee it, because ever since those companies blew up in the last like 8 months, my revenue has gone way down. And because it's independent stuff and I haven't put out something new, but I have a feeling that deals are being cut. And because it's a private company, it's not like public radio where it's a payola thing. I'm sure they can fucking do whatever they want. Hey, ProPublica or Russia, if you're listening, please hack the emails of SiriusXM. That was a little Donald Trump joke there for you. But so I didn't give over my rights to that, and that was very lucrative for me because I didn't trust them that they gave a shit about making me famous or whatever. I think they were just trying to build up their catalog, which in the aggregate, that's what they're looking to do. To each individual comedian, you go, well, I could be making $5,000 a year or I could be making $2,500 a year, but with their promotion and their weight behind me. But what these album labels are looking at is like, we're going to make this album for $5,000 or for $2,000. And then we're going to take half of this forever. If they blow up, great. If they don't, well, we own half of 300 comedians' labels. And we're going to be making tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, or even thousands, maybe even a month, if breaking it down properly. So that's where the comedy business is right now. And why did I bring this up? Comedy Max, my new album. Well, that, yes, ha, bring it back to Aaron. So basically Aaron and knowing that he's a bootstraps building his own business by taking risks on himself, is I can absolutely trust him. And I know he's coming at this from the same place as me. And the percentages he gives artists are better than the percentages these other places give. But a lot of people are suckers for labels or for, it's the hopelessness, the same hopelessness that bringer shows in comedy rely on, which is, well, I can't get to this club because I don't have credits, but if I bring 10 people, I'll go. And then there, if I have a decent set, the person will definitely come up to me and go, wow, you were amazing. You should do another show. That was so great. And they're just pumping you up full of gas because they want you and your friends' money. And to me, that's what I think a lot of people suffer from in the album game. It's like everybody says that do-it-yourself shit. But the only people, there's only two people who believe in the do-it-yourself thing. Me, and I'm a failure, but I have lived that credo. And people who used to have managers and used to be on TV or radio or movies, who didn't quite make where they want to make, but they still have a built-in infrastructure of hundreds of thousands of social media followers, and then do it themselves and then claim they did it themselves, ignoring like the foundation that was built on the strength of middlemen, industry people, agents, managers, etc. Those are the only two people who preach do-it-yourself, me and liars. So that was a long way of saying that's why I'm working with Aaron and why I haven't worked with anybody else, because I know I have enough of a grounding. I am very arrogant about my talent, but not about my station in life and not about my success, because I haven't had a ton. But I am not stupid enough and ego-driven enough to believe the bullshit when these people come at me and go, hey, we'd love to work on it, but no, you wouldn't. You want to take some of my fucking money. And that's what I wish more comedians would realize. But it's scary. And the ego trip of like, oh, they're going to get me on the new and noteworthy albums on iTunes. Like, that's pretty cool. And they'll pay for the artwork and stuff. I've paid for every album of mine, from artwork to recording to editing. I've done it all myself, and it has been profitable. It hasn't made me a millionaire, but it has without question been the most profitable venture. And part of that stems from the fact that I'm really good. And I was able to, through other avenues, build myself up, like getting on Dan Le Batard show, getting on Adam Carolla, et cetera. These were all things that I did by myself, solo. I made videos that cost me tens of thousands of dollars over a decade because I made so many. But they built my YouTube channel into something decent, nothing superb. I didn't become an influencer or a YouTube mogul, but I was proud of the work I did. And all that helped to get a little bit more of a platform for my albums and whatnot. But making albums and being good at comedy and trying to make a little bit of a name for myself has been the most profitable portion of my comedy career. And that's what the album makers know and want to do. They want to take that because they know it is the most lucrative way, especially for no-name comedians. It is the most lucrative place they can develop in the comedy world. And of course, they want to come in and take half of it. They want to take half of it from people who don't even have fucking careers but are desperate for any angle. And that's why I don't work with them, because I know it's just business. But I don't know how people can hear my voice and still work or look for, like, think that that's an angle. You are the fucking hustle. They are the house. They are the casino. They know what they're doing. They've done the math. They're more experienced in the business. They have bigger artists that they can lean on to promote their label. They don't need you. They want to take more money from you than they should, period. That's why I don't work with them. I'm not calling anybody out in particular. I think they're all probably the same. And it's business. But the fact is, that is the one area in comedy where I'll be like, absolutely, you should absolutely do it your fucking self. Period. You're giving away half of the best stream of revenue that is available to any artist that isn't a big star. So that's JL's comedy business seminar. And the other thing, and I guess I'll jump to this and then I'll go back to the topics I was going to start with, but that's a way of saying the new Fireside Crafts, the Deuce album, I think is going to be superb. It took me 6 hours to record. Big Huck, if you listen to my Trump podcast, Sharon Spell and Lauren Lugadici. God, I always fuck up her name, but I know I love her last name. It's this awesome Italian name, but I always fuck it up. And that's why her email is, well, I won't say what her email is, but that's why it's an abbreviated form of the last name. But she comes on to do a Melania track. Sharon from who's been made several appearances as Sarah Huckabee Sanders on Making Podcasts Great Again, does a great track as Huck. And it's, I could barely talk at the end of the night. And I'm glad I took the day off because I didn't leave till nine. I got there at 3 and left at 9. But doing that voice and occupying that character is real vocal cord and soul crushing after a while. But that's my way of saying it's, and this is the kind of album I, you know, if you are a Trump supporter, God help you, but it's the kind of thing that will make anybody laugh. That's just a fact. It's not done. Obviously, I hate them. I think the man is disgusting. I think he's a horrible person, horrible president. I think his supporters are somewhere between brain dead and Hitler youth. But they, or just Hitler soldiers, whatever. Some of them, you see these guys walking around with their AR-15s. But the album itself is just a great sort of parody that, trust me, I've had enough Trump people come up to me before I could Purell myself after and tell me I'm a Trump person, but God, that's so funny what you do. So it's that, it's who knows how it will sell or how much streaming we'll get, but hopefully we can get out there soon. Cause it's awesome. It was really fun to do. And there is just some really tremendous fucking comedy on that album. So looking forward to that, but I will say this and the other thing about comedy in general, where it's going, I've noticed a lot of people release albums and it's, you know, SoundCloud rap was like a, what crack and AIDS were to the 80s, I feel like SoundCloud is to rap and comedy. In terms of now, it's not about making a great song or doing a lot of verses. It's about making a two-minute song that can get a lot of streams and a lot of plays. So it's about letting the art be dictated by the medium instead of the medium being dictated by the art. And it's so funny because in the movie Bohemian Rhapsody, it was a big thing of like, he wanted, hello, darling, I want to make a six-minute song. That was my Rami Malek, Freddie Mercury. I'm putting my teeth. Okay, anyway, I think you can hear that I'm doing something weird with my mouth. But the whole thing when that was like, look how stupid the label is. Queen wants to make this six-minute song that's going to be so awesome called Bohemian Rhapsody. And they're like, it's too long for radio. Ha, ha, ha. The artist showed him. That spirit is fucking dead. Now we're all like, oh, what? 1 minute and 49 seconds? A mumble rap song with one verse? Yeah, that'll get a billion streams and then you'll be super famous and we'll all be like more intellectually diseased because of it. And comedy's doing the same thing, I think. Like comedy, to me, Gary Gulman is like, you know, he's thriving now. He's blowing up. I'm actually seeing him on Friday at New Jersey Performing Arts Center in Newark. Whenever I say Newark, I want to say it like Al Pacino in Heat when he's talking to Hank Azaria and he goes, "You will be extradited to Newark." It was like he had never heard of Newark. So he's like, "Newark." But Gary Goldman is an example of a guy who does bits that are 3, 4, 8, 9 minutes long. And they're just so good. And they show that, like, you should let the artist make art. And Gary Goldman will never be somebody. But he's fortunate to now be so big that, like, now he's his own thing. He is a star of comedy. So nobody's going to have him compromise. And there's always going to be demand for his work. But I've seen it with a lot of comedy albums where it's like people banging out, like, the 2-minute tracks and this and that. And that's great. If that's your style, by all means, don't change it. But, you know, bits used to be a little longer. Like, I don't think everybody is a SoundCloud comedian. You know, but and that's what I noticed is that my streams for Thoughts and Prayers are way down from like the other albums I've done in the past. And I think it's because there's several tracks that are really loud. I mean, really long and loud, but really long tracks. But I'm just in the mindset of like, well, this is the comedian I am. And these aren't long stories without punchlines and jokes in between. But like a lot of the stuff I do builds. Sometimes it takes 6 minutes. That's why Gary Goldman's one of my heroes and one of my sort of role models in comedy and inspirations is because, yeah, I like to do more in depth. I like to maybe sometimes an idea needs 5 minutes. I mean, I have a 15-minute track on Thoughts and Prayers, which is obviously just in a world of its own. And I'm proud of it because I managed to really keep the laughs going for the whole 15 minutes, which I thought was, it's one of my great accomplishments because I took something that was incredibly painful for me. And just put it out there and manage to try and make every fucking minute of that 15 minutes funny. But so go stream that. Pandora, please, if you're a streamer. I'd appreciate you going on Pandora because they pay way better than Spotify. Or just buy the album, cheapest on CD Baby. But I feel like, once again, just like I refused to do a show on the Kumia Network, why I stopped going on Adam Carolla's show, etc., I try to live some of my values, and my comedy is very important to me, both as an artist and just as a person. It's the way I've dealt with problems. It's the way I express myself when I'm down or when things aren't going well. It allows me to sublimate bad things, bad feelings into like something positive. And I can't compromise that. I don't want to be like, well, what if I just did a new album, Trump album aside, because that's its own thing. What if I did a new stand-up album where instead I make every track 90 seconds? I should get it. But that's not how I do comedy. But now we're kind of favoring the bup, bup, bup. Here's 5 minutes. Here's Instagram. Here's Twitter. Here's like a little video that boom, boom, boom. And it's like, this is not, you know, I just think, you know, I've joked with people. I said, you know, stand-up comedy is in its mumble rap phase. And I really think it is. And now it's just being invaded by people who haven't learned stand-up comedy through stand-up comedy. They've become successful. I've seen several mediocre comedians, and I mean real fucking mediocrities, blow up because they found their path through another medium. They got a fan base, and now their fan base just likes them. So they sell out rooms, they tour as headliners, and then it's like, but you have fans because you're now famous to them or you've done other things, but your stand-up is still a fucking mediocrity. But now the bottom line is, hey, you sell out rooms, you book tickets. That's what we do. And you do it under the guise of stand-up comedian. But you're really no different than, you're just a Stormy Daniels with more reps as far as your, but you're not, you took, you know, you were a recess appointment to make like a federal judge analogy. No, it's like you couldn't get confirmed the right way, so you sort of went a back door. And then your fans show up from the other thing, but then you cloak yourself as like a real-ass stand-up comedian or whatever. And it's like, come on. But that's what we're doing to the art. We're allowing people to find other channels to headlining, which weakens the product. Because the stand-up comedy art is not as pure. It's not as driven through the rigorous process that it used to be. And the other thing is, you know, the big revenue sources are now dictating, or people are encouraged to make shorter tracks. And it's like I said, if you do short tracks and that's just how you do comedy, more power to you. It's a great time to be you. But if you're adjusting your argument, you're saying, we really should make this short because I hate that. I fucking hate that. Like, it's like saying, hey, people don't want to read 600-page books. So, you know, Tom Wolfe, Stephen King, other people who are famous. Could you make your book 125 pages because that's what's hot right now? In fact, could you instead just make a series of memes instead of a book? Because that's how people consume their information. We're in a bad trajectory. If from rap to books to stand-up comedy, where the art is being dictated by the attention span and the revenue stream rather than the art being allowed to dictate by quality how and when and where people consume it. So that's me. I'm the fucking Moby Dick, the Herman Melville of stand-up comedians, I guess. And maybe when I die, my book and catalog will become hugely successful and classic. So there's a silver lining for you guys. I'm hopeful that sometime after my death, my art will be respected. But let's be honest, that's unlikely. People will mourn on Twitter. A few people will make jokes. And 2 weeks later, people will be like, you see that new show on Netflix? Anyway, so that's, wow, I did not expect to get into that. But hopefully, there, that's like some information for you about the stand-up comedy world and where I think it's going. But yeah, SoundCloud comedy is going to be the new thing. From podcasts and short tracks, we're going to continue to dilute the quality of comedy by letting people reverse engineer their success to say, well, I have a big crowd from my podcast, from my Vine account, which I know is not a thing anymore. So therefore, I am a good stand-up comedian, and they will continue to book me as a stand-up comedian because I've attracted dummies who never even were into stand-up comedy or just like George Takei memes. But now it doesn't really matter, does it? Because I have a crowd and they fill up a comedy club and they laugh. And therefore, it doesn't really matter if we're not producing as many Bill Burrs and Greg Giraldos and Patrice O'Neills. Instead, we have a bunch of fucking bros who scream about PC culture and a bunch of podcasters who fill up crowds and whose acts are at best middle of the road. So good luck, stand-up comedy, as I walk out like Morgan Freeman in a dashiki in the beginning scene of Lean On Me. Cue Guns N' Roses, podcasters fucking up everything, bros yelling about PC. Welcome to the jungle where the comics are hacks. JL is in a law firm because he fucking needs to make stacks. And he's pissed because comedy is no longer funny. But I'm doing a terrible Axl Rose, and let's get back to me. Other things in the jungle. Welcome to the hack jungle where you're going to podcast. That's terrible, I know, but I think you get what I'm saying. So let's talk about some other fun stuff before we get to Donald Trump threatening Adam Schiff's life. No new gigs coming up. That's par for the course, but I did hype up the Trump album. And please check out Making Podcasts Great Again. That is free. But yeah, check it out. And also, I don't have a lot of reviews on iTunes, not a lot of ratings. That would be great for the algorithms or whatever else they want to shove up my butt. From iTunes, Apple Tunes, Apple Cook. Give it a review. Give it some 5 stars. And also check out Making Podcasts Great Again because that's a real fun show. let's see. I saw Moulin Rouge on Broadway. I liked it. I thought it was good. Girlfriend liked it a lot. But we had a the understudy was the female lead when we saw it, and I liked her. I thought she looked like a combination of Anne Hathaway and the prostitute that lived in my building in Manhattan. And so I thought that was cute and perfectly on brand because she's playing sort of an artist slash prostitute in Moulin Rouge. So I was like, great casting because she looks just like the prostitute that lived in my building and also like Anne Hathaway. So great casting. She's very, very talented. But my girlfriend is like a lot of people who find Anne Hathaway, like Anne Hathaway is like the Hillary Clinton of acting. People are just like, yeah, I don't like her. And I'm like, well, did you see her boobs in Brokeback Mountain? Because I'm a fan. boom, 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 boom. Best score maybe ever, Brokeback Mountain. The guy definitely said to the musician, was like, here's what I need for a score. My movie's about really sad cowboys. Nailed it, and that's why it won Best Score at the Oscars. But Anne Hathaway, the Hillary Clinton of Hollywood, where people are just like, some people are like, I like her. She's talented. And then other people are like, I hate her guts. So Moulin Rouge. So we're there, and I try to sit into my seat, and I cannot fit in. And look up my blog. If you look up my blog on my website about Ain't Too Proud, which is the phenomenal musical about the Temptations that is on Broadway, the seats there, because they've now added all these premium seats, or as I call them, preemies. I thought the premium seats were just for better views of the theater, but they also have better legroom. But of course, you know, like airplanes, the Broadway theaters are not going to give up seats and revenue. So they basically just squeeze all the other seats even closer together. So they were always tight fits for me. Now they are literally impossible fits. And I'm not referencing weight I've put on. I'm talking about my height. My knees almost broke the wood in the chair in front of me at Moulin Rouge. Now, it Ain't Too Proud, we got sit in one of those cool like balconies where you're just in like a nice plush chair that sits on its own. So I just got to stretch my legs out and enjoy the show. It was fucking awesome. But for Moulin Rouge, they were like, we have to move you upstairs into a freestanding chair in the middle of the mezzanine, and we can only do that for one chair. And I was like, you can't downgrade my girlfriend so I can sit next to her. She's got to sit here with two orchestra seats that cost me a pretty penny while I go up and sit like some sort of... I either looked like a bodyguard of somebody or like a date, like the boyfriend of like a mediocre level person in the musical. Like if I was dating the main chick, they wouldn't have sat me there. I'd be in like a premium seat. But for this, it looked like, oh, he must be dating one of the ensemble bitches. So I just sat there by myself in like the walkway of the mezzanine, and I'm like, you could have fit at least six more chairs here. I don't know why you had to. It's not like we were getting something better. We were downgrading so I could fit. But instead, I sat there by myself, looking like a weirdo. And the opening number, much like the movie Moulin Rouge, which I think is very overrated, although Nicole Kidman, it was the last great-looking Nicole Kidman we'd ever see, where she was just statuesque and fairly young and beautiful, and the surgeries had not started. It's like a decent movie, very depressing at the end, which is always weird for like a musical that's all... Basically, it feels like Richard Simmons fucked Billy Porter and did LSD. That's what the opening of both the movie Moulin Rouge and the musical Moulin Rouge felt like. So slightly heterosexual is what I'm saying. No, very on fire and fuego, but it settles in, and it's pretty good after that. Like I found myself kind of chuckling, not at the jokes, which were terrible, but at just the, oh, that's a good usage of that pop song. And oh, I like what they did there. So it was overall like enjoyable. I'd say it was enjoyable. But I was pissed about the seats. It was very annoying. And also the other thing I noticed, and this is a good segue, Broadway audiences, nothing gets Broadway audiences going, you go, girl, okay, between the women, the fruit flies, I believe is the now appropriate term. No, between the women who want to be, like, progressive and woke but probably vote for Trump and live in, like, apartments that their fathers pay for while they bang their third wives who are younger than them, and... the gay men and the women in a crowd, nothing makes them go, you go, girl, more than like a middle-aged gay man getting like sassy and feeling himself on stage. And I'm reading the bio, like one of the main characters. I'm like, this guy's been in like 20 productions and nominated for 6 Tonys. He doesn't need your condescending. Woo! But there it was. There was tons of it. But overall, it was solid. I think other than obviously something like Hamilton, Ain't Too Proud is still probably my favorite thing that's playing right now. We're banging out some more. We're seeing Evan Hansen, Dear Evan Hansen, in a few weeks, so I'm looking forward to that. Finally got tickets to that now that the sort of it's not no longer like an impossible ticket to get. So I'm looking forward to that. So that'll be the next Broadway update. But speaking of extremely heterosexual people that get way too much credit. Bowen Yang on SNL. no, SNL. I watched SNL last night with Adam Driver, who's like secretly become like my girlfriend's huge crush. I guess just living with a tall, brooding person has made her more like into that sort of thing. But I actually think Adam Driver seems like pretty cool. He's a pretty talented guy, just from what I see in like his work. I don't know the fucking man. But I was actually looking forward to the episode, and boy, did it disappoint. I fucking hated this episode of SNL. Like so much to the point that I'm like, I'm going to continue to tape it, but I'm just going to start going to bed at like 11 on Saturday so I can get up, go to an earlier mass, and then once again decide whether to have red velvet cake or go to the gym. Callback. But I thought the episode was fucking atrocious. First off, Halsey, as I call her, cute, untalented pink. What? Who is Halsey? Why is she? I mean, she's going to become an actress, right? Because she's not that good a singer. She's just like breathy and really hot. But let's be honest, her choice of tattoos, if she were like a pale, not hot chick, we'd be like, where did they get this piece of white trash from? Because she's got like these sporadic tattoos all over. Like, and that was a time I got drunk with Tommy and got like a thigh tattoo. And then that was a time I decided I really like stars. So I got a star on my elbow like a Russian gangster. I'm not citing her exact tattoos, but it seems very haphazard and stupid, her sort of array of tattoos. But she's super pretty and very like fit looking. And so like she's going to become an actress. She's already hosted SNL. I don't get the fascination. Like Pink, even though Pink abandoned her first shot at stardom, which was like, I'm the white chick who likes to fuck dudes of color. That if anybody knows her original stuff, like there you go. It was definitely like, oh, this is going to be she's like the white chick from Breakin' 2. Is that the vibe she's going for? And then all of a sudden they're like, Pink, this isn't selling and you've got a seriously powerful voice. So can you for the next decade to 15 years do very yearning or happy songs, either about being broken up with because you're very sad and you're going to survive, or you're happy that you broke up and you're fucking awesome. And it's worked because her catalog is pretty goddamn good. But that has been Pink's career. It was like you went from, oh, it's the down-ass white chick who kind of likes, are those light-skinned black dudes or Puerto Ricans in her video? There you go. And then they're like, yeah, people don't want this. Sorry. Nobody's asking for White Lady Timberlake. And so then she was like, what if I'm really in pain and I really belt it? And then I also get really fit and do acrobatic live shows. All this sounds like I'm criticizing Pink, but I think Pink is awesome. So this is just me being funny. But Halsey to me is like, whoa, who's Pink's younger, hotter, way less talented sister? And people are like, oh my God, she hosted SNL. Now she's another musical guest again. I don't get it. I do not get it. But the overall episode I thought was just disappointing from start to finish. It was like, oh my God, they got John Lovitz to play Alan Dershowitz. Boy, is that irrelevant and not on the money and not a good impression. And does anybody in the core audience give a shit who John Lovitz is? His last moment of fame was like 25 years ago. I think The Wedding Singer was the last time he did anything of note. And it's not like he was on SNL, but he's not like a Dana Carvey where it's like, okay, it's been a while, but Dana Carvey is like a Hall of Fame first ballot legend SNL performer. But I was like watching it, I was just like, yeah, this is not worth me waiting up for anymore. I might as well just get into a better sleep schedule and not disrupt it. Get to bed by like 11 on Saturdays, get up, say my prayers, eat my vitamins, and then go have some red velvet cake. That's got to be my Sunday ritual from here on out. But did not enjoy the episode. I did enjoy the very final sketch, which was like a Heinz ketchup marrying joke sketch. It was kind of weird, but me and the GF actually did really enjoy that one. And that was like it. Everything else I thought the episode pretty much really sucked. And even so, even their opening sketch, Beck Bennett and Cecily Strong as Mitch McConnell and Susan Collins, I would have just rather watched them because I thought they were doing a great job. And then they had to take it to some ridiculous level and blah, blah, blah. And I can't understand a show that says, we need to reach young people. That's why we have superstar Pete Davidson with no impressions, no characters, and 6 seasons on the show. That's why we have him. But also, hey, young people, remember John Lovitz? No, you weren't even born when The Wedding Singer came out. Well, like 10 years before The Wedding Singer, he was kind of popular as like a third-tier player on our show. So wait till he comes on and does his non-impression of Alan Dershowitz. It's going to rock your socks off. So the episode really fucking sucked, and I'm sort of over SNL. It feels very lazy. And can't wait till Baldwin comes back on to do his breathy nonsense as Trump. And by the way, before I go on my Bowen Yang question, Pete Davidson, his new film with Judd Apatow is headlining South by Southwest Festival. So why don't we can we just name him president in like 2032? Can we just, cause like this train is obviously never going to stop. It's never going to stop. Like his rise to fame is never going to stop, and he never will have to do anything to actually earn it. He's 6 years on SNL, and he has yet to do anything memorable, though my 12-year-old nephew does enjoy his okay character. So I guess there's that. But yeah, headlining South by Southwest, which now we have to reevaluate my rankings for who benefited most from 9/11 have to change. Because obviously it used to be Rudy Giuliani won, Osama bin Laden two, and those two flip-flopped. Sometimes bin Laden was at number one, obviously in the immediate aftermath he was number one, but Giuliani really, really made a run for the title. And Pete Davidson was probably a distant third. But I mean, at this point, now with bin Laden dead and Giuliani disgraced, has anybody benefited from 9/11 more than Pete Davidson? I don't think so. So congratulations, Pete. You got the Never Forget title. So there he goes, starring in a movie, because I know a lot of people have been clamoring for, we need more Pete Davidson. We need more of the things we haven't seen on SNL, like characters, impressions, talent. But we do enjoy his every 4 weeks doing a 5-minute stand-up bit, sitting down, and we can update. And that is a powerhouse when it comes to that. And I know it sounds like I'm picking on him, but at some point, I know I'm a comedian, but I also do this podcast to critique celebrity and entertainment culture. And he's part of that. He's a celebrity, and so fuck it. Obviously, most people will tippy-toe around this bullshit, but fuck it. Why should I not be able to talk about Saturday Night Live and critique it? Anyway, Bowen Yang. All I can think of when I see Bowen Yang, who had a big article in the New York Times, apparently he's getting the You Go Girl treatment. You know, call back to what I described from Moulin Rouge. But whenever I see Bowen Yang on screen doing whatever character he's doing, it always basically seems and sounds the same. Now, obviously, if I sounded like John Wayne and every impression I did sounded like John Wayne, people would be like, he has no range. But because Bowen Yang sounds, you know, very effeminate, or even if not effeminate, what one might consider stereotypically gay, nobody can ever say, you want to try a different voice there or a different accent or a different diction or speech choice or speech pattern? No, we're just, every character is going to sound. I'm reminded of the great Greg Giraldo. Whenever Bowen Yang's on screen, and he's getting a lot of buzz and a lot of shine right now. And to be fair, he's doing a shit ton more than Pete Davidson, obviously. But whenever he talks, the only voice in my head is the late great comedian Greg Giraldo, and I want to go, I mean, that's got to be some kind of a choice, right? Like snacks, sir. Would you like some snacks? No, snacks then. That I think of that bit every time BY Jelly is on screen. But good for him. I mean, obviously, he was a writer, too. So who gives a shit what I think? It's good for him. He's having a nice moment and a great career. And that's so great for him. Let me get back to my New Jersey bunker podcast. Oh, wait, I guess. Oh, no. Now we got to talk about Trump. OK, so tune out, everybody, if you're tired of Trump talk and you just want to zone out and you're just so tired and everybody thinks they're right. And I love like the cynical centrists who, you know, who carry a bit of that libertarian smug, like nothing I say ever gets done. So I, instead of feeling unaccomplished and unimportant, I actually take on, I'm doing my Ron Reagan as an atheist voice. I don't know if there's ever been a more smug commercial in my life. Not afraid of burning in hell. I don't care if you're atheist or not. Those commercials suck. Like, I could see those commercials converting people to Christianity. Because it's like, I mean, I don't think I believe in God, but I definitely don't want to be on the side of Ron Reagan. Burning in hell. I hate those fucking commercials. Ron Reagan, for Americans, for non-God in money and politics. I don't think you need the burning in hell. If you don't know those commercials, look them up. I think that was a decent impression. But God, those commercials would be like, they're like the opposite. I feel like a Donald Trump's presidency is a daily challenge to my faith, because I'm like, this guy, I know we're all supposed to pray for people, and we're supposed to hope people find the light and not judge, because if he were to genuinely ask for forgiveness or feel a conversion or a change of spirit, or then you got to be happy. But if there's ever been somebody who feels very incapable of changing or finding the light or just becoming a better person, he seems to really be that person. Like if a Christmas Carol was about Trump, you know what he'd do? He'd rape Tiny Tim's mom and make Bob Cratchit and Tiny Tim watch. That's what he would do on Christmas morning. He's like, do you want that job? You still want the job where I'm a tough boss? Then I need you to watch me bang your wife. Tiny Tim, don't cover your eyes. This is how the real world works. Bah humbug, right in her ass. That's what I feel like a Christmas Carol with Trump would be. He'd be visited by the three ghosts. Like the ghost, oh my God, is this a new sketch, guys? Let's just work this out orally right now. He's first visited by the ghost of Roy Cohn, who's like, Donald, I have AIDS. Do better. And he's like, I prefer lawyers who don't die of AIDS. You and Tom Hanks can go fuck yourselves. And then he gets visited by the ghosts of Christmas past, where he's like, you know, sees that his father was like attending Klan rallies and being racist to black people. And he's like, nothing wrong there. Then he's visited by the ghost of Christmas present, who's like, remember how Ivana, maybe this would be ghost of Christmas past, but it's like, remember how your first wife actually helped you build a business and you fucked it up? No, I guess that would be ghost of Christmas past. Ghost of Christmas present would have to be what? He'd see, like, you know, what would he see? He'd just see what he's fucking doing. And, like, he'd see kids in cages and be like, well, ghost of Christmas present. Obama did it first. So fuck you. And then the ghost of Christmas future, he'd see, like, his own tombstone. And they'd be like, oh, my God, he died. And he had no friends. And he'd be like, but did I finally get to bang Ivanka? Well, then I probably died very happy. And as you see, my tombstone, very gold, very big. And then that would be it. Then he would just wake up the next morning on Christmas and be like, well, going to go see if I can gangbang Cratchit's wife while Cratchit and his crippled kid have to watch. Ho, 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 bah humbug, right in her butt. So my point in doing that impromptu a Trump carol, which really, you know, I should probably produce for Broadway at this point. Who wants to, anybody have any Broadway writing experience? Let's do that for next Christmas. A Trump carol. It'd be huge. I would play Trump, and we'd have to get, obviously, a hot chick to play Bob Cratchit's wife, because I'm not getting down with any regular chick on that stage. Did that sound too Harvey Weinstein-y or James Franco? We'd have James Franco come in and be our sex scene consultant. I don't know why that made me laugh, but last week's New York Times Magazine had an article about, like, a, I forget what they call them, like a sex scene choreographer or something for, like, regular movies. In porn, it's just they pretend it's real, and then really it's just a dude going, take it in the mouth, bitch. But that, you know, sex work is real work. And but the point is, I try to think about what Trump is doing to my soul. Am I becoming too angry? And am I becoming too unforgiving? And then I see that he threatens Adam Schiff on a Sunday. You know, probably after leaving church, obviously, because he's the most Christian, most pro-life president we've ever had. But he basically says Adam Schiff has not yet paid for his treachery to the country. He is corrupt, lying, shifty Schiff. And I was just like, everybody's like, that sounds really like a threat. Considering that he's had psychos try to bomb politicians and enemies of his, it's not as crazy as one might pretend. Like the sensible centrist who says, you know, one guy's racist and the other guy's not. But I'm going to be very sensible and say the truth is in the middle. So I think half racism is the right path to go. And it's like, no, no, no. Trump is Trump is wrong. He's 100% fucking wrong. So therefore, being 100% against him is the right path to be. Being like, well, Trump, yes, Trump may have raped people and he's racist and he is definitely trying to incite violence through his tweets. But he never said in his tweet, I think one of my supporters should go murder Adam Schiff. Therefore, you are wrong. I am sensible. I win. You are just another crazy lib dem. This is what's wrong with America. What did Trump do now? Another woman came out saying he raped her. Did Trump also say his daughter's hot? Did Trump also threaten another member of Congress? Did Trump put kids in cages? Is Trump changing the tax code to only benefit the wealthy and real estate people? Well, that seems just like a coincidence, and I think you're a crazy lib dem who is ruining the discourse. The truth is somewhere in the middle. My grandpappy loves Trump, and he's okay by my book, so the truth must be somewhere between your crazy democratic liberal nonsense and maybe people who are not my grandfather but that support Trump. The end. I'm sensible. Yeah. I mean, at this point, I mean, is Adam Schiff like is going to be the fucking John Brown of the Trump Civil War? Because let me tell you something. Adam Schiff is a fucking American hero, and there is no way around it. Now, you may not like, hey, I'm talking to the Trump supporters listening. You may not like Shifty Schiff, and let's not pretend like Shifty isn't like, you might as well say that shrewd money handler, Adam Schiff, because I'm sure there's nothing. His background plays no role in why he's being attacked and how he's being attacked. But he was absolutely fucking brilliant, and he laid it out. And here's the thing. Trump is guilty. He is guilty as sin. The case has been made. It's like you can say, and the problem is you can say, and this is my whole problem with where we are in America now. We have finally been exposed as a hypocritical country who doesn't really give a shit about the things we pretend to care about. Now, I went to law school, and the only classes I really did well in for, and very convenient for this discussion, constitutional law and my criminal law classes were the only ones I really excelled in. The rest of my classes, I ranged from mediocre to bad. But those are the ones I really fucking crushed. And Neil Katyal, by the way, who's been all over cable news as sort of a chief kind of legal expert critic of Trump, wrote one of my recommendations for employment after law school. So there you go. There you have your connection to... So basically, those were the classes I did well. I'm not pretending to be a scholar at this point, but I went to a good law school and I excelled in some of the relevant classes that are on display now. He is guilty, but people really don't ever care. People now care about the Constitution as much as it can be used as a weapon. But the funny thing is a lot of the people who would critique Obama, especially the Twitter heads who would refer to themselves as quote unquote constitutionalists. Let me tell you something. There's two people who you can avoid like the fucking plague on social media. Two types. People whose Twitter bios start with faith, family, freedom. They suck. They're fucking garbage people. Once again, I have no problem with faith. I have no problem with family. I have no problem with freedom. I like all three of those things. That's me. I like all three. But there is a 100% circle Venn diagram amongst assholes. Actually, no, I shouldn't say that. Twitter bio, it's not a Venn diagram because there's a lot of other assholes too. But if your Twitter bio says faith, family, freedom, or something like that, like God, country, family, you suck. You absolutely suck. Not because you believe in those things or cherish those things, because those are good things, in my opinion. It's if that is how you put yourself out in the world on Twitter, you 100% certainly fucking suck. Faith, family, freedom, Second Amendment, no niggers. I'm just an American. Like, it might as well be your Twitter buyer might as well have a Sam Elliott voice. The things I like. Faith, family, freedom, whites, no niggers, purity, guns, American flag. Like, that's basically might as well be your Twitter bio. And so those people you can just throw off a fucking intellectual cliff. The other one is people who refer to themselves in their Twitter bios as constitutionalists. I once had an argument with a guy on Twitter just for fun with that. And he was lecturing me, and I was like, well, I actually got a really good grade at Georgetown for my con law class, just to be like, shut up, stop lecturing me, you're an idiot. And he was like, oh, Georgetown law, that liberal, so a liberal law school is where you learned law, please. And I was like, wow, you are so fucking dumb. You are, yeah, that's right. The Catholic law school where like Laura Ingraham went to law school is a real bastion of, I mean, of course, as Stephen Colbert, to paraphrase Stephen Colbert, of course, the law has a notorious liberal bias. But yeah, those two people, Faith Family Freedom Twitter bio, get out of here. And if you refer to yourself as a fictional thing that doesn't exist, aka a constitutionalist, you need to go off that intellectual cliff with your Faith Family Freedom people. but at this point, it's like, if you're in that boat where you're like, I just don't want people like JL to be right, then fine. Fuck off. I get it. You're spiteful or you just don't want me to be right, whatever, or people like me to be right. But we're watching an absolute incompetent, cruel, racist, sexually abusing tyrant. And I'm almost done with the book by the Washington Post reporters, A Very Stable Genius. It's on top of the moral vacuum that he is. Trump is also really bad at the job. He really is. He's a good politician in terms of he's figured out how to use media, how to communicate with the drooling masses of MAGA. But as an actual worker, as somebody, he is fucking terrible. He's actually bad at the job. That's how you know it's not about the policies, because if they fucking impeach and removed him as they absolutely should, because as they've said, and you don't have to trust me, just fucking read a little bit. If you just read something, you'd understand this. To the people who go, both sides, both sides. I know you don't read. I know you don't read, and then you think the readers are fucking some. Maybe Trump's next step is like some sort of Chinese cultural revolution where all the scholars and artists get fucking executed. Maybe that's the next step for Trump. Maybe Russia isn't his model. Maybe it's like 1940s China. Or 50s China is his real model for success. But read. Don't sound like an ignorant idiot, because this guy is not a close case. This isn't a scholars differ. It's like he's the climate change of presidents. If you disagree with how bad it is, then you're a fucking idiot. Okay? Because he's not a close case. At all. At all. No matter what your grandpappy thinks, or your racist aunt, or your friend at the fucking factory, he's a fucking monster. And that's it. He's a terrible person. There's nothing you can say good about him. He's a rubber stamp for judges. That's about it. And a lot of the judges he has put obviously some very credentialed conservatives. Hey, Neil Gorsuch on the court, I'm okay with that. And I'll tell you why. It really should have been Merrick Garland, and then the Kavanaugh spot should have gone to Neil Gorsuch. And the reason I would be okay with Neil Gorsuch, not because I agree with him, but he's an accomplished jurist, and when a Republican or conservative gets elected president, one of the consequences, one of the rewards, is he gets to appoint judges. They don't have to get confirmed, but Neil Gorsuch was is well within the, hey, he's a conservative, accomplished guy. He gets to go on the court. He should win his nomination. I have a problem with his order because Merrick Garland never even got a fucking hearing. And that doesn't even matter to people. That should be alone disqualifying for Mitch McConnell. That alone should be disqualifying for Mitch McConnell. But it's not to people because they pretend to care, but they don't read and they don't actually care. The Constitution is used as like an ignorant weapon by people. And this is the one time, on both sides, but way worse for the conservatives and the Republicans who pretend to be textualists and we care about the text. They don't care about the fucking text. They care about winning, and that's it. And their drooling masses that will follow them will just go, Obama's violating the Constitution. Obama, fucking that motherfucker was fucking, you didn't say anything about Obama when he violated the Constitution. And it's like, how did he do that? What's your example? You know what, man? Fucking fuck you then. If you don't think, you know, if we're going to have this discussion. No, tell me how he violated. You know what? You know. And you're just playing that fucking game. This is why nobody likes fucking Washington, D.C. This is why nobody likes politics, because you can't fucking even admit when your guy was fucking wrong. No, I'm just asking, what did he do? What was his violation that wasn't addressed through the courts or through some other means? Like, what did he get away? What, how did he violate? you know what, man? You like Trump? I like Trump. You like Obama? I mean, we just aren't going to fucking agree. Okay, good discussion. Good chat. Good chat, fella. MAGA. It's horseshit. And to threaten Adam Schiff, I think, is so fucking disgraceful. And these fucking senators in the GOP are so fucking spineless. Because it's like, Adam Schiff is brilliant. And he made this clear, cogent, compassionate, emotional plea using the facts, arguing well. And I love when they're like, Schiff is crazy. He's unhinged. And it's like, Adam Schiff is, it's like motherfucking calling Bob Ross, like, out of control. Like, is that when Republicans see Bob Ross painting little clouds, they're like, this guy's a fucking maniac. Because that's like, you call Adam Schiff crazy and a maniac, you might as well be calling Bob Ross a fucking lunatic. That's the kind of cadence and calm he seems to have for 95% of his presentations during this trial. But he's not going to get impeached. And then you get into that argument. It's the same argument when people say, hey, is your life worse with Trump? Then what the fuck is the big deal? Because I don't vote only as a selfish individual. If I have wiggle room to pay more in taxes, or that it won't hurt me if somebody does, if there's a candidate who will do more for more people, that's okay. And if it hurts me a little bit, that's okay. If it doesn't hurt me, that's great. But I cannot vote simply on my taxes. They took 26% of my income last year, but under Trump, they take 24.9%. So fuck everybody, because that's a win for this guy. And I feel the same way about impeachment. And if you want to be cynical about it, then you should at least be honest about your cynicism and say, well, he's not going to get removed. Well, then why is that on the fault of Adam Schiff and Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats? Isn't that the fault of the GOP? Because you're not saying he didn't do something wrong. You're not saying he's not. You're saying it's not going to happen. So what was the point of all this? The point is sometimes, to quote Gary Gulman, when he got cut in line at Trader Joe's in one of my favorite bits by him. And the woman said to him, who came back, she said, well, if it means that much to you, then take it. And he said, what means so much? Justice? And it was hilarious because he was just talking about a line at Trader Joe's, but he was right. And I remember laughing hysterically the first time I heard that joke live. But that's what it is. So we shouldn't hold him responsible because other people are also cowards and crooks and uncaring. This is literally like the Trump version of To Kill a Mockingbird would be this. Why is Atticus Finch even making this fucking case? You know, these racist jurors are just going to convict that Negro. Wouldn't that be a more interesting book? The Trump version of it. I'm redoing all new series for my YouTube channel. Trump Does the Classics. We've already got a Trump Carol instead of a Christmas Carol. Now we're doing To Kill a Trumping Bird. Or to Trump a Mockingbird. Instead, you get to the trial, and instead of Atticus Finch saying words like the temerity, instead they just go, Atticus shows up at court and goes, well, seems like this jury's racist. Sorry, Tom, you're on your own. Good luck at the hanging. And that's the Trump version, because why argue the case? Why do justice? Why do the right thing when you should just do nothing? Because, hey, the Senate, the old white, you know, and they share a lot in common, a bunch of old white dudes in both juries. Hey, they're not going to do the right thing. So what was the point? To stand up for justice, to do the right thing? Now, those same people, when the shoe is on the other foot, will all of a sudden become strict constitutionalists, just like they showed the hypocrisy of people like Lindsey Graham, who are like, sometimes it's about doing the right thing. My word, Bill Clinton. Could I see those pictures of Bill Clinton's penis again just for research? Thank you. Oh, I got the vapors. Right? He was all fucking, it's about more than just technicalities and the law and the words of the law. It's about the spirit of the law. It's about upholding our values. And now it's like, Donald Trump did nothing wrong. And there are no pictures of me sucking dick in the possession of Vladimir Putin. So that's what we're at. That's where we're at. And I just think the idea that we've reached this point where not only will Trump get off, but that people will actually argue that both from a stance of ignorance and cynicism, there's this coalition on the right that is just this amazing, like the big three, like instead of Dwayne Wade, Chris Bosh, and LeBron James, it's like we've got racism, ignorance, and cynicism, and they are going to win the title for Trump. It's pathetic. So like, not only is he guilty, but you ignore that or say like, I've had a conversation with somebody who was like, I mean, it was bad, but is it that bad? And I go, you know, everybody says wait for the election. Here's my analogy for that. If you're playing a basketball game and you're about to tip off, okay, or the game is 2 hours away, and then you get word that the other team tried to bribe the officials. And then you get to the game and you go, well, this game's got to be forfeit, right? They got a forfeit. And you go, guys, you're here. The other team's here. Let's play the game. We're already here. Let's play the game. That's how we should decide who should win this game. It's like, but you just told me they were trying to bribe the refs. How can we trust this process? And isn't that a bad enough crime that they should just forfeit the game, regardless of how the outcome would be? Shouldn't they just forfeit the game? How do we know they didn't bribe other refs? How do we know they won't bribe refs in the next round if they beat us? Just play the game. Stop being a fucking bitch. Okay, we're here. The game. The fans think that the game should be decided by play on the court. So just do it, you fucking cunt. And it's like, no. You can't. He was trying. Here's the thing that Trump did in my theory of this, and it's not complicated. One of the things that cost Hillary Clinton the election, yes, maybe she was a bad campaigner. Okay, I'll just give that to you. She campaigned poorly. Even though she was favored in national polls and the national polls sort of lined up with the popular vote, she campaigned poorly. Her information was wrong. She thought Wisconsin and Michigan were in the bag. She thought Pennsylvania was in the bag. So she was in fucking North Carolina and Arizona trying to run up the score. Bad decision, Hillary. Bad campaign strategy. You lose. Okay. One of the things that did indisputably help those bubble voters, those undecideds with a week or two to go, was Comey reannouncing 11 days before the election that he was reopening the Hillary Clinton investigation. Studies and data have shown that that did swing undecided voters. Maybe not the entire swing, but it helped. It has been proven to have helped. So Trump, being the sort of feral wild animal running on egotistical instinct, sees that and says, wait a second, I know what I'll do. You know, Joe Biden's the guy who they say might beat me. So here's what I'm going to do. We can't have our own FBI announce an investigation because they don't have anything on them. But I'll pressure a foreign government who needs us, where there is a connection. Even if it's a bullshit connection that's been not disputed, but been debunked. Even though we have this debunked connection, we still have a connection. And most people don't read. I don't read. So these motherfuckers who follow me don't read. They just listen to me. Let's get Ukraine, who we can pressure. Let's get them to announce that Joe Biden is fucking corrupt and that they're investigating him. Because then that'll be like the Comey announcement. Perfect. And on top of that, I will have hurt my chief rival and I will have helped myself in the election because I think I can beat Bernie or Warren, but Biden is going to be tougher. So when your answer is wait for the election, you mean the election he was trying to fucking rig, the election he was trying to fuck with his bullshit mafioso intimidation of Ukraine, wait for the election he was trying to rig. And then if you say it's okay what he did, why wouldn't he keep fucking rigging it? Like, why wouldn't he then ask, as he already has, ask China to look into information, to announce investigations, to dig up dirt? Because then you're giving him the green light. And if you don't see that, if you're somebody who's going, what's the point? You know what? You can't be talking out of both. You can. You're a fucking, if you're a Republican or a Trump person, you probably can talk out of both sides of your mouth very easily. But it's like, you can't be the party of American leadership counts, our values count, and then be like, but if our president has no values and is a racist rapist who tries to rig elections, fuck it. So Trump is an animal who learns, you know, like an animal in a laboratory, and he has taken the lessons. He has taken the lessons that investigations being announced can hurt his opponents, even if they are formidable opponents. He has learned that he can get away with encouraging and cooperating with foreign interference. He has learned that, even if done unintentionally, he can benefit from foreign interference. So he's added these lessons like a simple animal who's learning where to get its food. Oh, the bowl is where I get the food. That's what he has learned. And the biggest, worst lesson he will learn from this is, wow, This time I did it all intentionally and got away with it. So now I am going to fucking have Rudy Giuliani running around the globe if I get acquitted in this trial, trying to fucking totally use the world to destroy my political opponents. And if you think that's okay, then you are a shitty American and either a dummy or a shitty person. And there's no way around it, because this guy is the absolute worst our country has ever produced, certainly as a president, possibly as a person. He embodies just about everything that is wrong with American history. He is a man who has inherited wealth. He is a corrupt man. He is a man with no values. He is a sexually assaulting white supremacist. He is a man who he's like a greatest hits of America's worst attributes, all thrown into one. You know, the only thing missing is, will we find out he has like a mixed race baby from a woman he took advantage of years ago? That's it. That's like the only other thing left. Speaking of which, is that why I talk so much like Trump? What if I am Trump's mixed race rape baby? And on that note, guys, that is a terrible note to leave. But who's to say actually, the pro-life guy would have had that baby aborted. Just, you know, get rid of the evidence. Because he's the most pro-life president we've ever had. Even supporters, how many abortions do you think Donald Trump's paid for? 8 was the number that was sort of circulating in sort of third source media materials. But I don't think it's less than 5. Because he's the most pro-life president we've ever had. So it's if it wasn't so sad and so historically significant, it'd be pathetic and kind of funny. But he's the worst we've ever produced, certainly as a president and maybe as a person. So this has been a really good episode, I think, right? We hit on everything. I think I was pretty funny. I think I was also very serious. I'm happy with this. I think I'm finally, you know what? It's like an athlete who took that year off and they were wondering if he was ever going to be good again. This was like Jordan coming back from the Birmingham Barons, and this is my 55 I dropped in the garden. It's like, okay, JL Podcaster is back. And on that note, guys, thank you for listening. Please give me the 5 stars on iTunes. Spread the word. And also, if you're listening to this, and please, I hope you're still listening. I'm not on Facebook. I've been very vocal about why I'm not on Facebook. But obviously, I have many listeners who have not tuned back yet. I was, you know, clicking in at probably, let's just say, many hundreds of listens. You know, I was creeping in the high hundreds, and I'm only in like the low hundreds right now. So obviously there's a lot of people. So if you can tweet, if you can maybe mention it on your podcast, and if you can maybe post something on Facebook, not permanently, but just now, just to make people aware. Obviously, I won't see your Facebook messages, but if you can make people aware that the show is back, I'd greatly appreciate it. And I think this would be an awesome episode. This would be kind of a real, in its totality, excellent episode. If you've ever liked anything I've done, I really threw everything at it. There was homophobia, there was sexism, there was Trump, there was Broadway musicals, there was comedy business critique. It really had everything for everybody that ever listened to me. So thank you for listening. Please give me some of those reviews, some of those 5-star ratings. Check out Making Podcasts Great Again, available on all sorts of platforms, and spread the word about the show. Much appreciated. I'll put this one up early so you have more time with it to marinate and share the word. So thank you, and I will see you next Tuesday.